Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain.
Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some. Hey, greetings, my friends. And happy Tuesday to you. A beautiful day here on the 20th of March all across the United States and around the planet. Tom Hartman here with you. In the second hour of our program, I'll be debating conservative Larry Pratt on whether the Second Amendment protects the right of individuals to own a gun, or is it all about militias? In fact, our quote for the day from Chris Rock: gun control? We need bullet control. I think every bullet should cost $5,000, because if a bullet costs $5,000, we wouldn't have any innocent bystanders. Yeah, interesting. So, anyway, and a lot going on in the news today. And in our third hour, by the way, Christy Harvey will be here from the Center for American Progress. A lot going on in the news today. George Bush called Alberto Gonzalez and said, "You're doing a heck of a job, Albie," or Al, whatever his nickname for Mr. Gonzalez is. That's something we need to track down. And it turns out that it's fairly common for White House aides to testify before Congress, at least common for everybody except the Nixon and Bush W. Jr. administration. So we'll be getting into all of that as we go through the 3 hours of our program today. But I want to start with the Great Global Warming Swindle. This is the title of a documentary, so-called, that is running on British television, that is on the web, that apparently was shown to Republican members of the United States House and Senate, which has led to over 80% of them saying that they do not believe that there is a global warming crisis or a climate change crisis. And I want to share some clips of this and get some feedback from a guy who really has done the research and really does know what he's talking about. Ross Gelbspan was a reporter and editor for 30 years of the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. At the Globe, he conceived, directed, and edited a series of articles that won a Pulitzer Prize. In 1997, he published a book called The Heat Is On. And I read it when it first came out, and it really got my attention. The book got particular attention when then-President Clinton told the press he was reading it. His Ross Gelbspan's second book, Boiling Point, published in 2004, received the lead review in the Sunday New York Times Book Review. It was reviewed by Al Gore. His website, Ross's website, is heatisonline.org. Ross Gelbspan, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great to have you with us, Ross. And I want to take a little time here. We may need to take more than even just the first segment of the show, because I've got a bunch of clips from this documentary. And I just, because this is being so heavily played in the conservative community, the conservative blogosphere is flying this thing around. The so-called documentary is getting hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of hits. It's being, as I said, being shown to members of Congress. I want to just take some excerpts from it and have you rebut them or respond to them, if that's
sure.
All right with you. Okay, so here's one of the first, saying that the temperature on Earth is by the narrator of the movie, is a consequence of sunspot variations and not carbon dioxide. Here we go.
In 1991, senior scientists at the Danish Meteorological Institute decided to compile a record of sunspots in the 20th century and compare it with the temperature record. What they found was an incredibly close correlation between what the sun was doing and changes in temperature on Earth. Solar activity, they found, rose sharply to 1940, fell back for four decades until the 1970s, and then rose again after that.
And then he goes on to point out that temperatures did the same thing. Your response?
Okay. A couple of points that he's making here. The first one is the relationship between solar activity and the warming of the planet. And basically what the scientists have found out is that up until, probably the early part of the 20th century, the sun was the dominant influence on the climate. It exerted about 85% of what's called the external influence on the climate. But with the rise of greenhouse gases, they really swamped the influence of the sun. So that today, solar changes exert maybe about 15% influence on the climate, and greenhouse gases about 85%.
So they neglected to mention that in the movie.
They neglected to mention that, for sure. Yeah. The other point that's really interesting is they do mention the fact that the warming proceeded until about 1940, sort of plateaued for about 30 years until about 1970, and since then it's been going up at an incredibly fast rate. And the reason for that is a little bit complicated, but when we burn coal and oil, we put up two things. We put up carbon dioxide, which stays up there for 100 years and traps in heat. We also put up lower-level particulates. They're the things that make for air pollution, and they actually cool the planet. They reflect the sunlight back into space. And the period from 1940 to 1970 is the period when the world was industrializing around World War II. There was a huge increase in manufacturing. There was also a great deal of debris put up from all the bombings and so forth. And so you did have an offset effect from all these lower-level pollutants. And then when they settled out in the late 60s and the 70s, the heating resumed. And, in fact, it has been warming since then at a pace that exceeds any in the last 10,000 years. So that's
so it was,
the reason for that plateau.
Yeah, it was the 1970s that we actually started getting serious about cleaning up our air. I mean, my recollection is the Cuyahoga River caught on fire in the early 70s.
Well, that's right. That's right. And so, for example, the British ecologist James Lovelock today makes the point that if we were to really clean up air pollution around the world, and that includes places like India and China that are dependent on their coal, and Mexico and Nigeria that burn lots of oil, if we were to radically clean up our air, we would see a huge spike in heating. And so,
because there would be less reflected sunlight as a consequence of all the particulate matter in the atmosphere.
That's exactly right.
So that, wow, that could be an unintended consequence. Okay, here's another quote. This is the new so-called documentary, The Great Global Warming Swindle, suggesting that when things get warm, that's a desirable thing.
It's important that people know that climate enabled a quite different lifestyle in the medieval period. We have this view today that warming is going to have apocalyptic outcomes. In fact, wherever you describe this warm period, it appears to be associated with riches.
We're having a heat wave.
In Europe, this was the great age of the cathedral builders, a time when, according to Chaucer, vineyards flourished even in the north of England.
All over the city of London, there are little memories of the vineyards that grew in the medieval warm period. So this was a wonderfully rich time. And this little church, in a sense, symbolizes it, because it comes from a period of great wealth.
So, and they're talking about the medieval warming period was good times for Europe.
It probably was a good time, because it was coming out of a very cold period, and it did allow more grapes to grow and so forth. But that's all within what's called the range of natural variability, with traditionally is an upper limit and a lower limit, and so that was a warmer upper limit, and it certainly was very good. That was before there was things like greenhouse gases. That was before we were changing the climate. And the real concern here, Tom, is that the planet, as it's warming up, we can't arrest global warming at any particular comfort level. If we could, it would be great. But the scientists right now are projecting that the climate will increase from, 3 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit within this century. And if you look at what's happening around the world right now, the glaciers are melting, violent weather's increasing all over the world. Plants, animals, birds, insects, whole ecosystems are migrating toward the poles in search of stable temperatures. We have the ice caps melting. All that has happened from 1 degree of warming. And so if we could stop it right here, it may be a more pleasant world, but we are not in control. And what scientists are really concerned about is runaway climate change, whereby the warming sort of takes on its own internal dynamics and just really trashes the planet in a big way. So, as I say, if we could control it and bring on another little medieval warm period and stop it right there, that'd be great. Unfortunately, we don't have those kind of controls for the thermostat that controls the planet's climate.
Okay. Here's another clip from and I'm going to ask Alex to just push this break back a little bit here. I'm going to play one more clip from this so-called documentary, The Great Global Warming Swindle, and we'll get your response on that.
Okay. When we look at climate on long scales, we're looking for geological material that actually records climate. If we're to take an ice sample, for example, we use isotopes to reconstruct temperature, but the atmosphere that's imprisoned in that ice we liberate, and then we look at the CO2 content. So here we're looking at the ice core record from Vostok, And in the red, we see temperature going up from early time to later time at a very key interval when we came out of a glaciation. And we see the temperature going up, and then we see the CO2 coming up. CO2 lags behind that increase. It's got an 800-year lag. So temperature is leading CO2 by 800 years. CO2 clearly cannot be causing temperature changes. It's a product of temperature. It's following temperature changes.
So their point is that CO2 is a result of biological activity that increases as a consequence of temperature going up, and that we have it backwards. Ross, I'm sorry. We did the break just started. We'll get your answer on the other side. We're talking with Ross Gelbspan. Heatisonline.org is his website. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Philadelphia Bulletin, Washington Post, Boston Globe. His author of The Boiling Point and The Heat Is On. And we're debunking the great global warming swindle, the Republicans' favorite movie right now. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Razzle-dazzle, you razzle-dazzle them. You gave them an act with...
Global warming is an issue that my administration is very concerned about, deeply. Deeply, in a deep, kind of concerned way. I start my day and I think about the warming of the globe and how we can get it warmer.
Cut!
You played them both right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Ross Gelbspan. Heatisonline.org is website. We're talking about this new documentary out of England that all the Republicans are all agog about, saying that Al Gore's wrong on everything. Ross, the last clip that we just heard, and I'll just again play the last 10 seconds of it just to recap it, suggests that carbon dioxide levels actually follow warming rather than precede it.
CO2 clearly cannot be causing temperature changes. It's a product of temperature. It's following temperature changes.
So, your response.
Okay. If you look at CO2, Tom, when the Earth was formed, the atmosphere was mostly CO2, and over the years it got drawn way down to where it's now something like 0.003% of the atmosphere. Basically, it's not a question as to whether CO2 causes warming or whether warming generates CO2. It's sort of a dance between the two of them, and it's a feedback mechanism. So, for example, when we had some early CO2 that helped promote plant life. The plants absorbed the CO2, produced more oxygen. But then as we have the plants decaying and decomposing and so forth, more volcanic eruptions, it put up more CO2. And if you look at the temperature records, the changes in Earth temperature and the changes in carbon dioxide concentrations track each other perfectly. So what you have here is a feedback between the generation of CO2, the warming which generates CO2, and so forth. Now, what's really interesting about that is that process sort of stabilized itself. It stabilized itself, probably about 600,000 years ago. And for the last 10,000 years, we have the same amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, about 280 parts per million, which really created good conditions for the civilization to develop. And that was because...
And thus our civilization being only about 10,000 years old.
That's right. That's right. And we had this 280 parts per million, and it was pretty constant. But that was from the natural sources of CO2. Since we have begun to industrialize using coal and oil, we have upped that 280 parts per million to 380 parts per million, and the temperatures begun to skyrocket. So it's sort of not important whether or not which comes first, the chicken or the egg. The point is it's in a mutual feedback cycle, and the more CO2 we pump up there, the more heat we get down here, and it's
right.
There's no question about that.
So for millions of years, we had a relatively unstable system, or at least a system that was going through wide oscillations in temperature that had to do with a whole bunch of variables from tectonic activity to meteorites to sun activity.
Exactly.
And we're within the context of that now, but now we've thrown a new variable in, and that's massively increasing the CO2 levels by man-made activity.
Exactly.
Is that a good way of summarizing it? Okay, here's another clip. This is suggesting that the ocean has a memory, and therefore all of our numbers are meaningless.
The ocean has a memory of past events running out as far as 10,000 years. So, for example, if somebody says, oh, I'm seeing changes in the North Atlantic, this must mean that the climate system is changing. It may only mean that something happened in a remote part of the ocean decades or hundreds of years ago, whose effects are now beginning to show up in the North Atlantic.
So the point being that the ice cap that's receding from the Arctic is got nothing to do with the increases in carbon dioxide over the last 100 years. It's from something that happened 300-400 years and maybe 10,000 years ago. Might have been a volcanic activity.
Certainly doesn't seem that way. But again, what's really important about these changes, Tom, is the rate at which they're taking place, and that really is what is alarming the scientists. It's the rate of these changes. So, for example, you have had three big pieces of Antarctic ice shelves break off due to warming water since 1995. All three of them are bigger than the size of the state of Rhode Island. That has not happened in that kind of a 10, 12, 15-year period in prehistory. There's no record of that whatsoever. The changes that are referred to here have been very gradual, very slow, and they've come and gone and ebbed and flowed. And what we're seeing now is very radical, sudden changes. And in fact, what we're seeing, if you're talking about the oceans, is an extraordinary phenomenon where the oceans have been detected to have warmed up down to a depth of 2 miles. Now, that's extraordinary given the inertia of the oceans. And that is only because of the forcing of our atmospheric warming.
And that's an enormous amount of heat to heat that much water. That's a lot
Absolutely.
Of mass. Compared to the mass of the atmosphere. We're talking to Ross Gelspan. Ross, can you stick around for one more segment?
Absolutely, Tom.
Great. I still have another 5 or 6 clips from this movie I'd like to share with you and get your rebuttal to. Ross Gelspan's website, heatisonline.org, for more information. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. This is a very, very timely topic. Philip Cooney, the former chief of staff to President Bush's Council on Environmental Quality, the guy who made hundreds of edits in the government's climate reports. This is from a report over at thinkprogress.org, to play down human activity and global warming. A guy who is not a climate scientist. Appeared yesterday before Henry Waxman's committee, and they asked him, you know, were you making these edits because it comported with good science, or were you making these edits because you were doing what the administration wanted done based on their policy? And he said, quote, what is driving the policy of this administration on global warming and climate change, excuse me, the question was, is what is driving the policy of this administration on global warming and climate change the science or something called politically correct science? Cooney says, quote, my objective was to align these communications with the administration's stated policy. We're fixing the facts to meet the policy. I fixed the facts. It's the same as the Downing Street memo. So we're talking with Ross Gelspan, the author of The Heat Is On and other books. And his website, heatisonline.org. And just going through this, and we're just going to spend a few more minutes with this. I realize this is a lot of time, and typically what we're doing is I'm debating conservatives on this show. Here we have Ross and I debating this movie. because this is a huge topic. Al Gore is going to be testifying tomorrow before Congress on this. The day after that, they're going to have Bjorn Lundborg on, I believe, who's the guy who's going to be putting out a lot of these talking points that you're hearing in this movie right now. And I want to immunize you in advance, give Ross an opportunity to tell you what about these things. So, Ross, welcome back.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Laura Dawson, in this is what, for those who may have just tuned in, there's a Channel 4 in England, in the United Kingdom, TV show that has come out that is all the rage among conservatives. It's been shown to Republican members of the House and the Senate. It's called The Great Global Warming Swindle, and it alleges that, you know, don't worry, be happy. There's nothing to worry about here. This is all nonsense. And just, you know, playing some clips from this and getting Ross's response on them. This is Lord Dawson discussing the mini ice age.
In the 14th century, Europe plunged into the little ice age. And where we would look for evidence of this are the old illustrations and prints and pictures of old Father Thames. Because during the hardest and toughest winters of that little ice age, the Thames would freeze over. And there were wonderful ice fairs held on the Thames, skating and people actually selling things on the ice.
So the point they're making in the last clip that we played in the last segment, Ross, was that there was this medieval warming period, and here this little ice age, that these temperature variations, these temperature fluctuations from the Thames being frozen over to there being vineyards in northern England, are just all part of the natural scheme of things. And thus, you know, changes that are happening right now are part of the natural scheme of things.
It is certainly true of changes that happened back then, Tom. I mean, the climate is subject to wild swings, but they've happened within certain limitations. And you can't compare the Little Ice Age, the medieval warm period, to what we're seeing now. For example, 11 of the 12 hottest years on record have happened in the past 12 years. The five hottest consecutive years ever are 91 to 95. The planet is heating at a rate faster than any time in the last 10,000 years. So what we're seeing today is really off the charts, and it goes way beyond the oscillations that we've been used to, which is normally part of our traditional climate.
So the medieval warming period and the freezing of the Thames, the little ice age, were both within that normal variation range.
Absolutely.
And we are now swinging outside of that.
Exactly right.
Yeah, okay. Patrick Moore, he was the co-founder of Greenpeace, and he's in this movie here now. He's become a climate denier, and he takes a whack at you and me and all, you know, everybody who has a position on this.
The shift to climate being a major focal point came about for two very distinct reasons. The first reason was because by the mid-80s, a majority of people now agreed with all of the reasonable things we in the environmental movement were saying they should do. Now, when a majority of people agree with you, it's pretty hard to remain confrontational with them. And so the only way to remain anti-establishment was to adopt ever more extreme positions.
And then here's another person saying essentially the same thing, that this is all the conspiracy theory of why folks like you and I are talking about this.
Well, carbon dioxide clearly is an industrial gas, and tied in with economic growth, with transportation in cars, with what we call civilization. And there are forces in the environmental movement they're simply against economic growth. They think that's bad.
So it's all people, you know, Greens who are frustrated because, in fact, they were right and back in the 80s, and everybody agreed with them, and so now they're taking out their frustrations by trying to destroy civilization.
Well, there are really two points here, Tom, and both of them are absolutely off the wall. Moore is saying he's sort of attributing this whole thing to an emotional recalcitrance and people being upset because their extreme positions, which is nuts. What we know about the climate doesn't come from the environmentalists. It comes from more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. A bunch of these scientists were themselves initially skeptical about climate change, And then I'm thinking of people like Tom Carroll, this very, very respected scientist, until they really looked at the data, really began to understand the mechanisms and said, holy cow, this can only be due to greenhouse warming. Nothing else explains it. So this has nothing to do with the environmental movement. The environmentalists did not give us the basis on which to understand global warming. They've sort of taken it and run with it, and they may be subject to criticisms, that's fine, but they're not the source of our information. The second quote, which sounded like it came from Fred Singer, was basically saying that people who are sort of promoting the idea of global warming are against economic growth. And that is absolutely nuts. It's not coal and oil that gives us economic growth, it's energy that gives us economic growth. And there's no question that we need energy for economic growth. So were we to get that same energy from windmills and from tidal power and wave power and solar panels and so forth, we could still have the same amount of economic growth. And in fact, in my book, Boiling Point, I outlined three strategies that would push a very rapid global energy transition to clean energy, and it would create millions and millions of jobs, especially in developing countries. There's no question about it. So it's not that coal and oil gives us economic growth. It's that energy is required for economic growth. And by all means, to increase the living standards in developing countries, we need to provide them energy and we need to provide them clean energy. And I would just add to that, the countries like India and China with their vast coal reserves are feeling the impacts in terms of air pollution and lung disease and acid rain. They would love to go clean energy. They just can't afford it. But if we were to help extend clean energy to those countries, they would snap it up in a minute. There is no resistance on their part
at all. Well, in fact, China recently has allocated $300 billion to solarization of an entire city out in the middle provinces. I mean, they're looking at this very seriously. Here's a I'm not sure who this speaker was. He's not attributed in the movie, but basically, again, back to our original point, saying that CO2 has nothing to do with this.
CO2 began to increase exponentially in about 1940, but the temperature actually began to decrease 1940, continued till about 1975. So this is opposite relation. When the CO2 is increasing rapidly, but yet the temperature is decreasing, then we cannot say that CO2 and the temperature go together.
Now, this is just, they're just restating the thing, and your rebuttal to this was that the period in 1940 was the industrialization that corresponded with World War II and the bombing of World War II that was happening all over the world. They increased aerosols in the air, particulate matter, that increased the reflectivity of the atmosphere, that cooled down the atmosphere for about a 30-year period. And then we started cleaning up all of our industrial pollutants in the 70s. Both in air and on land and in our rivers and things. And as a consequence of that cleaning up, then the warming became more noticeable, right?
Well, that's right. And it's not even that we cleaned it up. It's that these particulates only stay up there for, a couple of years, where CO2 stays up there for 100 years. So a lot of those pollutants naturally settled out. But that's exactly right.
I think we've covered basically all of the points that these guys are making in this the great global warming swindle, and here's one more.
When we saw this correlation between the temperature and solar activity or sunspot cycle lengths, then people said to us, "Okay, it can be just a coincidence."
Yeah, and then he says, "But it's not. It's all sunspots." And again, you say, yeah, it has been for millions of years. That's been a major correlation. But now human activity has shifted this.
That's right. Exactly. There was another argument that was made in the movie that had to do with satellite readings.
Right. Satellites versus balloons, wasn't it?
Satellites versus Earth surface temperature readings.
Earth surface, yeah.
Yeah. And basically that's also a false argument, because what happened was at first, the satellites did not reflect the kind of warming that we see, but that was because the satellites are in orbit, and these orbits change. They sort of, it's what's called orbital decay. Every time the satellite goes around, its orbit slightly changes, and when they recalibrated the thermometers on the satellites, it basically gave us, it confirmed the fact that what we know is happening, that the Earth is warming.
Okay, great. Ross Gelbspan, thanks so much for being with us, Ross. Go ahead.
My pleasure, Tom. I really appreciate you giving the issue the airtime. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's important. Ross's website, heatisonline.org. Check it out. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman program. Back with your calls right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I am following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War. I'm going to Graceland, Graceland.
And welcome back to the radio support group up by for We the People of the United States of America. This is going to be a, no pun intended, hot topic over the next few days. Here we have, in testimony yesterday before Henry Waxman's committee, the guy who was editing the Bush administration's policies on global warming, saying that he changed information not because it was good science, but because it conformed with the administration's stated policy, quoting him, to align these communications with the administration's stated policy, he says, was my objective. So he's fixing the data to match the policy being whatever big oil wants, big oil gets. No global warming, there's no global warming. At the same time, you're going to have Al Gore coming before Congress tomorrow, and the day after, you're going to have, you know, global warming deniers coming to Congress. This is the week for it, I'm telling you. So I just wanted you to be well pre-immunized. These are all what you have just heard in this conversation in the last 45 minutes between Ross Gelbspan and I are all the as far as I can tell, and we've done some pretty good research on this, all the major points that the global warming deniers are making. And the specific rebuttals for them. Michael in Mississippi on the line. Hey, Michael, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. The question is really in regards to fixing the problem of global warming. Assuming that the movie is false, and assuming that it is definitely a problem that's rapidly getting worse. It has been established that it would take about 30 Kyoto treaties for us to really do something about this problem. And just knowing that 30 Kyoto treaties, the world is not going to agree to that because it would cripple the world economy. This question was really for Ross, but I know he's gone now. But what is the real solution to fixing this problem? Thanks, and I'll hang up and take your comments.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Michael. I appreciate it. First of all, 30 Kyoto treaties is a number that has been pulled out of the hat by the guys on the right. Although you're right that the Kyoto Treaty itself, which would roll emission standards back to where they were in the 90s, in the early 90s, as I recall, is not enough, is nowhere near enough. And we do have to go beyond that. But the fact of the matter is that there is enough solar power on the planet to power the planet. There's enough wind power on the planet to power the planet, and we have the technology to extract it. It's just not widely distributed. And if we were to engage in a Manhattan-style project to say we're going to start using the energy, the renewable energies that are hitting this planet right now, we might be able to cut down the carbon dioxide emissions radically enough that we can arrest global warming before it hits a tipping point where it can't be stopped. And that's the big danger, is hitting that point of no return. There are some who argue we may have already, hit that point. But most of the scientists are more or less in the middle on this. No, we haven't hit it yet, but we're damn close. And if we're talking about something that is literally a global emergency, it's worth the effort, A, and B, it could produce, as Ross pointed out, a global boom. I mean, if you're making a transition to a new technology, look at what happened when the car replaced the horse. Look at what happened when computers came along. Look at what happened when television replaced radio to a large extent as the main medium of entertainment inside someone's home. Every single time there has been a revolution in technology, there has also been an explosion of economic activity. A revolution in energy technology will also bring about an explosion in economic opportunity. It need not be a bad thing. It can be a good thing. John in Fresno, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for the great show.
Well, thank you for listening to PT.
I think it's really a mistake to debate the deniers on this because it just gives them legitimacy. In the discussion, there were a couple of key words that I think really ought to be the do something about it now talking points. One is the had to do with the rate of change. We've never before seen a rate of rise of temperature as high as it is, and we've never before seen a rate of rise of CO2 as rapid as it is.
Actually, we have, but they've been around giant. I mean, Ring of Fire, volcanic activity, things that changed continents, or the hitting of the Earth by asteroids.
The other had to do, and I heard the word feedback in there. The thing that to me is most worrisome are the positive feedback mechanisms that some of the models have talked about. You know, the Earth gets a little warmer, the permafrost melts, more and more of the trapped gases, the methane.
Right, methane gets into the atmosphere, or that as the sea ice melts, it exposes water. Water absorbs heat. Ice reflects heat.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the final, I think, talking point ought to be, okay, consequences. You know, as the ocean's warm, gas is less soluble in warm water. There's going to be less CO2 held in solution in the oceans. As the temperature goes up, phytoplankton don't like it. Phytoplankton start to die off. Phytoplankton produce half the oxygen that is in the Earth's atmosphere, and coral reefs die. I mean, I think it needs to be condensed. The message.
Right. We could literally end up with an atmosphere that we can no longer breathe.
Yeah, and my concern is that while it's very intellectually satisfying to have these debates and you know, point by point, I think we need to learn from the neocons and be on point, on message, so we don't glaze the...
Well, that's what I'm trying to do right now, John, is to get the points out in advance, because I'm telling you, day after tomorrow, you know, Al Gore's going to testify tomorrow, and the day after, they're going to have the deniers on, and you're going to have Fox News and all the network, all this stuff is going to be out there, and I want people to know the answers to these things in advance. It's because they are going to be, you know, I guarantee you, the media, they got this whole, well, let's balance this thing, right? And it's wrong. It's a terrible thing. And thanks for listening to KFPT there. Hey, Clark in Tucson, Arizona. Clark, we've got just about a half a minute here before we've got to wrap it up. What's up?
Oh, thanks. I had a few quick points. First of all, I'm kind of curious who funded this British study.
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Well, of course not.
At least I wasn't able to find out who.
One thing is I'm not for economic growth. I am for economic stability. And if we could, you were asking about solutions. If the candidate for president got up and said, I'm going to make it my focus, my number one plan to dismantle the military-industrial complex and bring peace to the planet, would you vote for him?
In a heartbeat. In an absolute heartbeat. And, Clark, you make a good point about economic stability. I think growth is vastly overrated. In fact, there's a great Adbusters ad where they wrap it up by saying, if we are to survive, economists must learn to subtract. Because, you know, every time somebody gets cancer, it adds to economic activity. Is that a good thing? 57 minutes past the hour. Gun control up next.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. We recently had a change in Washington, D.C. The appeals court, this was in the case, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, that would be the first circuit, ruled 2-1. I believe it was a week ago Friday, I may be wrong on that, in a case called Parker versus District of Columbia, that the laws in the District of Columbia against private ownership of handguns in your home were illegal or unconstitutional. And this is interesting because in all probability, first of all, this will be overturned. It flies in the face of five Supreme Court precedents. But there are folks who think that this is just a fine thing and, in fact, are claiming it a victory for the Second Amendment. Larry Pratt, among them, he's the executive director of Gun Owners of America, gunowners.org, the website. Larry, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, how come, first of all, do I have the facts on this case right?
That is correct. The law has been on the books since 1976, and it was a law that was so strict that if you had a grandfathered handgun, had to have been registered in 1976 before the law was enacted, you'd have to get a permit to take the gun from one room to another in your house, and those permits were never given out.
And this was a law that was passed by whom?
The D.C. City Council. They also bore bore down very heavily on people who wanted to have a shotgun or ultimately they banned semi-automatic firearms, rifles. So if you wanted to have some other kind of rifle, you would have to get a permit. And from having interviewed a young lady who went through the process to do that, I can tell you that it was arduous and very time-consuming. It took her 7 months before she was able to take a permit out to a Northern Virginia gun store, because there are none in the district, and pick up the gun there. So, and then when she brought it back, even though it was a shotgun, it had to be trigger-locked and locked up in a safe. So obviously, self-defense was not an allowable use for the gun.
Right. Now, you're arguing, Larry Pratt, gunowners.org, you're arguing that this is a victory for the Second Amendment. I would submit to you that this has absolutely nothing to do with the Second Amendment, and the Supreme Court has said so five times. That, well, first of all, why do you think that people being able to freely, without any regulation or licensure, own any kind of handgun that they want or any kind of weapon in Washington, D.C. is a good thing, for that matter?
Well, first of all, the Supreme Court has actually only ruled as a ruling once, back in 1934, the Miller case. It has declined.
It was 39, actually.
39, I'm sorry, the law was 34, you're right. It has declined to rule on other occasions, but that being the case, that's the fact.
Well, not entirely. In Presser versus Illinois, the court came, which was in 1886, the court came right out and said that the states, the individual states, have the right to strictly regulate private military groups and the weapons that they use. It reaffirmed the Cruikshank decision. This was 1876, that said that the Second Amendment is not a limitation on the states; it's a limitation on the federal government. And
if you read what Cruikshank actually said, it went on to say that the right pre-existed the coming into being of the Constitution.
Exactly.
That was something that was part of the reasoning of Judge Silberman, who wrote for the majority in the case last week ago Friday.
That's being twisted around. I mean, what they were suggesting was that all rights preexisted the Constitution, and that in the Constitution the purpose of the Constitution is to limit the power of government, and the government has to pass a law in order to enhance its power. And if that law gets passed, then the power of government is enhanced, and that passing laws like restricting the ownership of guns is within the purview of the Constitution.
Well, actually, the Tenth Amendment has it just the opposite. If that power has not been specifically delegated to the federal government, then those powers have been reserved to the state.
Right. I'm talking about at the state level. I'm agreeing with you at the federal level, but I'm saying at the state level.
Well,
the essence of the Cruikshank decision was, and also Presser and Miller and Lewis in 1980, for that matter, was that, and Burton versus Stills in 1968, virtually all of them were that, you know, arguably at a federal level, you may or may not be able to regulate gun ownership, but at the state level, certainly this is up to the states.
And that's
why I think this is going to be overturned, because Washington, D.C.
Actually, I think what's going to happen is that assumption is going to be increasingly brought under a lot of scrutiny, because the states are no more at liberty to tamper with gun ownership than they are to pass a resolution saying, hey, the Speaker of the House is now Commander-in-Chief, no longer the President. You just can't go about unilaterally changing.
No, that would be a state trying to usurp federal government. The Second Amendment was an
institution that predated the coming into being of the Republic, of the Constitution, of the Bill of Rights, and it had a very precise legal meaning over about 150 years.
And militias are still part of U.S. code. You and I legally are members of the militia of the United States. It's still part of U.S. code.
Actually, the way U.S. code states it is problematic. Let's go and look at what the founders themselves were dealing with. They were dealing.
Well, that's what I want to get to. The Second Amendment in current form, let's work backwards from this. As ratified on September 21st in 1789, the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state. the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Okay.
Now, the version before that, which was submitted on September 9th, the 2 weeks earlier, said essentially the same thing. A well-regulated militia being not necessary to the security, but being the security of a free state. The right to the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Here's what you have to look at.
The version, well, let me just go through. There's three quick versions here. I'll give them to you and then you can respond. The version before that said a well-regulated militia being the best security of a free state, the right of the people shall not be infringed. The one before that said, and this was August 25th, this was submitted to the Senate, a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people being the best security of the free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, but no one religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person. And the one before that essentially said the same thing. What this was about was the debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists over whether we should have a standing army. And the Anti-Federalists, the people who became known as the Democratic Republicans, Jefferson's party, now known as the Democratic Party, said, no, we should not have a standing army during time of peace because they are the unending source of mischief in a democracy. And the Federalists, the people who were then reinvented as the Whigs and then reinvented as the Republican Party, were saying, yes, we should have a standing army.
All right, now let's take a look at what the Congress did in 1792, which was 5 months after the final ratification, last state's ratification of the Bill of Rights. They passed the Militia Act of 1792 and effectively codified what colonial law had been saying all along, namely, every man, and at that time it was every white man between the ages of 17 and 45, was in the militia, and they had to have a military gun, they had to have the ammunition for it, and they had
You're making my point, Larry, that that's what the Second Amendment was all about. It was that they didn't...
Not exactly your point, because they had to have the guns, and if they didn't have the guns, they were fined. They would be fined if they weren't in working
order. And the piece that you're leaving out of that is that those guns had to be kept in an armory.
No. They had to be kept at home. They would actually go door to door on occasion to make sure that the guns were actually there in that person's possession, because if there were an alarm, they had to come with their own gun. That is the actual historical record, and that was the law for some 150 years. These militia were chartered by the colonies, the states, if you will, but they were operated at the municipal and the county level. And as Judge Silberman pointed out, that militia, which was comprised of individuals having their own guns and keeping them at home, was for the protection of a free society. And that's what free state meant. They weren't
right, but they did not mean that you and I should have the right to have a gun so that we could overthrow the country.
They meant to be part of the defense
of the country. If they meant that, they would say we should have the right to have a cannon.
I waited for you. Give me a chance. They were trying to keep a free society, and the way to do that was to make sure that they had individuals armed in those local and county militias. That was what the right to keep and bear arms was all about. Individuals preserving a free society with their guns.
Right, a free society from the invasion of the British in, for example,
the
War of 1812.
From the invasion of their own government, and just as an expression of the fact that they were the sovereigns, we the people who hereby do establish this government.
Okay, Larry Pratt, gunowners.org, the website, Gun Owners of America. It's always an interesting debate with you, Larry. Thanks for being
here. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, I'm deeply sorry. What's wrong with me? I put my face between a bird and Dick Cheney. Accidents will happen and I should have ducked. I'm in love. I'm all shot up. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, well, my face is bloody, looking like Swiss cheese. Bird shots flying every time I sneeze. Who do you think of when you have such luck to be me?
I'm all shut up. Oh, yes, just don't get your face between Dick Cheney and a bird. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's the point for me in all of this, because my position on gun control is pretty clear, and that is that it should be a that there is no reason why anybody in the United States should be having weapons, essentially weapons of warfare. That 50 caliber guns, machine guns, shoulder fired surface-to-air missiles, rocket launchers, mortars, grenades, all of that stuff the only possible reason for having that inside the United States is for insurrection, is to take on the government. And that's, you know, it ain't going to happen. First of all, the founders did not put the Second Amendment in there so that we could take down our own government if it became onerous. It was for the defense of this government. And keep in mind, this was a time when they felt that they needed to be defended. We had the Spanish in the south. We had the Spanish in the west. We had the British and the Canadians to the north. And they actually attacked us in 1812. In fact, they marched all the way to Washington, D.C. and burned the White House. And you had Native Americans all around who were a little unhappy with Europeans taking their land. So that's why the Second Amendment was put into place, was to protect the country. And people say, oh, well, you know, you got to have guns, otherwise the government's going to become oppressive. Well, I'm sorry. If you think that you can take down this government with a honey rifle, you're sadly mistaken. And it was not what the founders had in mind anyway. You know, it's the way that you take control of the government of the United States is through the political process that's put into place and by getting enough people out there active and engaged. So with regard to guns, here you have devices that sole purpose is to harm or kill. And you could argue, and I think successfully, that means that if the reason why we license drivers in the United States is because a vehicle can harm or kill, even though that's not its intended purpose, that if we have devices whose intended purpose is to harm or kill, that it seems reasonable that there should be at least something similar to a driver's license for it. But there isn't in many cases. But, you know, frankly, I think that there should be. I think that there should be, you know, you should be able to demonstrate your proficiency with a weapon before you're allowed to own one. And this, you know, coming from a guy who, I go back to Michigan and visit with my brothers and my brother Steve, one of my three brothers. We every time I go back to Michigan, he and I and his significant other, we get down to the shooting range, you know, bling, bling, let's go shoot. And, you know, Steve owns a bunch of guns. I just rent them. And it's great, you know, it's toys for boys. It's fun. I've shot everything from an Uzi to a Sig 9. I mean, but the point is that I think it should be up to the local municipalities when you get down to the micro level. The needs of New York City and Washington, D.C. are very, very different from the needs of rural Vermont. The needs of city areas are different from the needs of rural areas. And they frankly, I think, should have the right, the ability to make those rules and those decisions for themselves at the local community level. But when you look back at the history of the Second Amendment, you get it that what these guys were all about with the Second Amendment was trying to do away with standing armies. This from September 23rd, 1787. This is right after the Constitution was first published in Pennsylvania. And this is from the Anti-Federalist. Had we a standing army when the British invaded our peaceful shores? Was it a standing army? The answer is no, by the way, to all these questions. Was rhetorical questions. Was it a standing army that gained the battles of Lexington and Bunker Hill that took the ill-fated Burgoyne? Was it not a well-regulated militia sufficient for every purpose of internal defense? Yes. And which of you, my fellow citizens, is afraid of any invasion from foreign powers that our brave militia will not be able to immediately repel? On December 18th, 1787, in Pennsylvania, they published their Address and Reasons of Dissent of the Minority of the Convention of the State of Pennsylvania, their constituents, and they said, and I quote, their specific objections to Article 1, Section 8, Article 2, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, they said, standing armies in time of peace are dangerous to liberty. They ought not to be kept up. A standing army in the hands of a government placed so independent of the people may be made a fatal instrument to overturn the public liberties. An ambitious man who may have the army at his devotion, they're talking about a president, may step onto the throne and seize upon absolute power. The absolute unqualified command that Congress has over the militia may be made instrumental to the destruction of all liberty, both public and private, whether of a personal, civil, or religious nature. Now, that was 2 years before the Second Amendment was written. And that's what led to the Second Amendment, was that kind of sentiment. The what were referred to as the Anti-Federalists in the 1780s, what became known as the Democratic Republicans by the 1790s and by the 1820s were called the Democratic Party, were saying, we do believe we should have a Navy to protect our shores. but we don't believe we should have a standing army. Instead, every member, every male between the ages of 17 and 47 should be a part of the militia to defend the country, the same way it is in Switzerland right now. Arguably, one of the reasons why Hitler didn't invade Switzerland. Because if he had, every single man in the country was the army. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
From out of the east, a stranger came, a law book in his hand. Oh, man, the kind of a man the West would need to tame a troubled land. 'Cause the point of a gun was the only law that liberty understood. When it came to shooting straight and fast, he was mighty good. Many a man.
And welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Air America Radio, the Tom Hartman Program, 34 minutes past the hour. That no standing army. This is one of the proposed amendments to the Constitution that preceded the actual processing of the Second Amendment. This was proposed by the Constitution, by the legislature of Pennsylvania as a federal amendment to the United States Constitution, formerly proposed in 1788. That no standing army of regular troops shall be raised or kept up in time of peace without the consent of two-thirds of both houses in Congress. That each state respectively shall have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia thereof. That the militia shall not be subject to martial law except when in actual service in time of war. Nor shall the militia of any state be continued in actual service longer than 2 months after any call by Congress without the consent of the legislature of such state. This is the origin of the Second Amendment. And you know, folks who run around and say, oh, what the Second Amendment says is that everybody should be able to own a gun. I'm sorry, it doesn't say that. Jack in San Diego, California. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm going to rely on what the Second Amendment does say. First of all, it protects the collective right, the state. Second of all, it protects the individual right, the people. And it doesn't mention hunting rifles.
The people is not an individual right. It's a collective right.
Well,
a person would be an individual right.
For example,
the 14th Amendment, where it says no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. That's an individual right. When the Second Amendment, when it refers to the people, it's a collective right.
I see. Well, then it would have been redundant then for them to mention the people. Is that what you're saying?
Sure.
Are you saying the Founding Fathers are redundant?
I'm saying
no,
that the Second Amendment is the result of a compromise.
Excuse me. The people is the individual right. Now, that's my interpretation. You can disagree with that. But the Second Amendment doesn't mention hunting rifles, and it doesn't mention guns. It mentions arms with a capital A, which includes all manner of guns and other weapons. If you want to look at the intent of the Founding Fathers, it was definitely for the family to be able to protect itself from insurrection and invasion. Those two words are used several times in the Constitution.
It was not for the family to be able to protect itself, Jack. I go back and read there's four Federalist Papers written on this by Hamilton and Madison. It was for the state to be able to protect itself from insurrection and invasion, communities to be able to protect themselves.
I disagree with you because they knew that you couldn't dial 911 back in those days. The family had to have the right to protect itself. And they wanted you to be able to have the arms sufficient to protect yourself from opposing forces, including invasion.
Now, the right to protect yourself preceded the Constitution, Jack. There's an absolute consensus on this. There have been five Supreme Court decisions that have said this. It was discussed in two of those four Federalist Papers that I'm talking about. Everybody agrees that the right to protect yourself doesn't
agree, and they were very clear. They used the word right, and they said shall not. They didn't say may not, and it said shall not be infringed. Now, do you think that licensing and training classes, if those are required, that maybe is not an infringement unless it precludes you from owning a weapon. Then it becomes
unless you're a member of a militia. what the Second Amendment says.
I think we're just going to have to agree to disagree on this one.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, because, you know, my point is that this, the goal of the Second Amendment was to establish state-based militias and not, and to fight, frankly, the tendency to have a federal militia. These guys, you know, the various states, the anti-federalists, did not want there to be a federal army. They felt it was a very dangerous thing. And Jefferson was very outspoken about this, for example. And Madison ultimately, although he had started out with the Federalists. And the whole point of the Second Amendment was to authorize, essentially, militias by the states.
Well, look, I'll concede this point. If my interpretation is correct, that maybe it's not applicable today, but then you need to have an amendment to the Second Amendment. Maybe it's time we need to have a constitutional convention.
No, I don't want that to happen, because it's just, I mean, the nastiness that could happen, the dirty tricks that could happen could be terrible. But I think if you extend your logic that this was all about arms and not specifically guns, then we should have the right to cannons. We should have the right to tanks.
Do you think
missiles?
Okay, and I can make an argument for something similar to that. Do you think?
Yeah,
that
so
there
can
could
I.
Be, wait a second. They had an invasion in Iraq. Do you think there could be an insurgency in Iraq if the people were only armed with hunting rifles?
Well, by and large, they are. AK-47s are not all that different from hunting rifles.
Did you ever see
in
the
fact,
movie
there
Red
are there
Dawn?
Are people who hunt with AK-47s.
Tom, did you ever see the movie Red Dawn?
No, I didn't.
Okay. You might want to look at it. It raised the possibility that we could be invaded here in this country.
Sure. Sure. And see, that's where I don't disagree with the anti-federalists that everybody should be part of a militia. And in Pennsylvania, in deference to our previous guest, I don't know about the going door to door to make sure you had a gun. But in Pennsylvania, the law, and this was actually part of the Constitution of Pennsylvania for the first decade or so of it being a state, was that every man 17 to 47 had to be in the militia, and their weapons had to be either in their home or stored in the local armory. And armories designated.
I understand that part, but what about my argument that the people means the individual? If you just go back to those days, don't you think the Founding Fathers wanted to protect the right of the individual and his family for them to be able to defend themselves because they couldn't call 911?
I think they believed that that right was absolutely pre-existent, that there was not – nobody was even debating that right back then.
Then we still have it. And they did say arms with a capital A. They didn't say guns or hunting rifles.
Yeah,
and, you know, they were very concise when they wrote the Constitution. They weren't very wordy, and every word had a meaning.
Right, and we still have the right to self-defense. The question is, what are the instruments that you're going to use to defend yourself? You might suggest that in order to defend yourself, you have to have a half-track with a 50-caliber machine gun mounted on the back of it.
Which is why we need an amendment today.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting discussion. Jack, I got to move along. There's other people who want to get in on this, but I appreciate the call. Thank you very much, and thanks for listening on KLSD. Chris in Santa Fe, New Mexico, KTRC. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I will say at the outset, you shouldn't get your face between Dick Cheney and the Constitution.
good point.
I agree with you as to the intent of the Founding Fathers when it comes to the Second Amendment. Just a blanket statement, I will say that I think any society wherein the government owns all the tools of coercive force, i.e. the guns, is by definition less free. Now, my point of view comes from the mountains of northern New Mexico, which is a different thing. But
well, I would agree with you, Chris, to the extent that by definition it is less... how to say it? Well, I'm not. Continue your point. I'm sorry.
Well, I do disagree with you as it comes to this recent decision in District of Columbia, the federal decision that just came down. I don't think it's going to be overturned, and I think that groups like the NRA, and there are a great many others, have enough impetus and money to push this all the way to the Supreme Court. And you have to understand, today's Supreme Court has Mr. Roberts and Mr. Alito and Mr. Thomas and Mr. Scalia, and it might be a different outcome altogether than it would have been 10 years ago.
It may well, and you may well be right, and if so, it'll be changing precedent that goes all the way back to the early 19th century.
I agree.
And my point is that you may be less free in, I'm just really wary of using the, even that language because it has different meanings to different people and it's so loaded, but you could say that, you know, where a state where the state is the only instrument of force is a, can be an oppressive state if the people don't have control over the state.
True.
And
in our case, the people are the state, or supposedly.
That's my point. I mean, you know, the extent to which we are free is not the extent to which we are armed, in my opinion. It's the extent to which we participate in our own governance.
I agree.
And I think that that's far more important, frankly. And that's where we're falling down. And I just, you know, it horrifies me to hear people say that the solution to an oppressive government in the United States is for everybody to have a weapon, when in fact the solution to it, the possibility of, or the reality, the growing reality of an oppressive government in the United States is political activity, is to get out there and get engaged.
Okay, so, and I agree with that as well, but I will say that the argument that it would be futile to take a hunting rifle to defend your home from an oppressive government is kind of a specious argument.
I'm not suggesting it would be futile. I'm just suggesting that it probably would be futile. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been within 100 yards of a Black Hawk helicopter, but probably futile.
It would probably be futile, but that doesn't make the argument that you wouldn't want to try.
Yeah, okay. I'll go along with you on that, Chris. Dave in Coastal Bend, Texas. Hey, Dave, got about a half a minute here before break. Yeah, is this a quick one?
Yeah, this is Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, all I was going to say is, you know, there's nothing in the Constitution, as far as I can interpret it, that would guarantee a 14-year-old inner-city gangbanger the right to have a flamethrower.
That's right. In fact, the Constitution doesn't grant rights, and that's the most important thing that people have to get, is that the Constitution doesn't grant rights. It limits the power of government.
Okay, and I think we have, well, the Constitution's been interpreted ever since it was written, to me, by course. Why can't we interpret it in today's terms rather than in terms of 230 years ago?
Well, we are, and we have been since the early 1800s.
Yeah, and I think we have to fine-tune the scope of this rhetoric, but I don't know how it's ever going to happen.
Well, I think it's happening gradually and incrementally, Dave, and reasonably, and thank you for the call, by the way, and in a not unreasonable fashion. And frankly, I think that this ruling in the Second District Court, or the First District Court, is a setback for it, although it's really fairly finely defined. I'll give you the details on that right after this break, 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour coming up on listener-supported radio here, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen to your local radio station for the local sponsors and let them know that you're listening. Tell your friends about their products. Patronize them. That's how you can support this radio program. And, of course, our national sponsors as well, Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacred.com, smalldog.com, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends, 866-380-MEOW. 9 minutes before the hour, in our chat room, Imbaleo, I think it says, sometimes I can't pronounce these screen names, my apologies. Tom, I have the right to defend myself from Blackwater. Yeah. Well, we'll actually be talking about that on the radio tomorrow. We're going to have the author of a new book about Blackwater on. But anyway, Frank in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Frank, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Just to give you a little side note, I am a big-time anti-this-war evangelical conservative. So just to give you an idea of roughly where I'm coming from.
Okay.
And a former member of the NRA and a current member of the Gun Owners of America. Points I'd like to bring up. And the first thing is
I'm a current member of the NRA.
Great. Well, there's a whole other story as to why I quit. I didn't think they were strong enough on gun rights. First of all, I'm heartened that you mentioned the Swiss example. A fellow by the name of General George Patton, who is the son of the General Patton, also an Army officer, and a Marine officer by the name of Lewis Walt. they teamed up and they did a study of the Swiss system of national defense. And the report's available online, and the name escapes me off the top of my head. But you can read it, and you can read how they do it. And what they do is precisely what Larry Pratt was arguing for. Every man owns his rifle. Every man reports for duty. The only guy that doesn't own a rifle is a conscientious objector, and he reports because he's in the military. He's in the medical corps.
Right. And this is what Jefferson was arguing for in the early days. And back in the days when the major threat to the nation was the possibility of an invasion from Canada or from Florida or from the Spanish in the Western states, or the British coming across the ocean, or for that matter, you know, native tribes down the road. It made sense, and you could even make a case that it makes sense today.
And
in fact, I'm on record as being in favor of compulsory national service of some kind, not necessarily
in that regard,
military
yes,
service.
I agree with you, as opposed to a draft.
But the point is that actually is a greater form of government interference and regulation in
ownership
of
firearms. Well, if you consider the government being the people, yes, it is. But the people are the ones. The power rises from the people. It doesn't come from the top down. It rises from the people.
I have this weird feeling, Frank, that we're arguing and disagreeing at the same time. Keep in mind, I lived 10 years in Vermont. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, and I'm not an attorney and I haven't checked Vermont's laws.
I'm not regulating
it. I was going to say, I've got a friend who an acquaintance who owned a gun shop in Vermont, and he told me, so this is hearsay, I guess, that, you know, I could basically buy any gun I wanted. I could do any damn thing I wanted with it in Vermont, and that's what the good citizens of Vermont want. I support that.
I need to correct you because one thing I keep hearing from you and from some of your callers is you go to the farcical extreme. Well, a 14-year-old gangbanger has no reason to own a flamethrower. No, but a man who has a wife and children for whose well-being and safety he is responsible, not the state, not the police department, but for whom he is responsible, he has every legitimate need, if he so desires, to own a 9mm Glock to defend himself from criminal attack.
What is
the opposition against that from you?
Well, the opposition to that, frankly, my personal opposition to that is fairly limited, but I believe that a community...
That's all they're arguing for in D.C.
The D.C. City Council elected on behalf of the citizens, the D.C. City Council decided that, the citizens of Washington, D.C., and the citizens of New York City, by the way, as well, to a large extent, decided that they were better served and better defended by their own police department than they were by all of their civilians having guns.
However, and you're probably aware of this, courts all around the country, when people have been victims of crime, and they're not even particular people who wanted to own a gun and they've been denied that right, they just feel that the police have an obligation to protect them, and they call 911, they're in the middle of an attack, they call 911, the police show up 3 hours later to mop up the blood and to draw the...
Oh, I know. I mean, take that up with George Bush, who pulled 100,000 of Bill Clinton's cops off the streets.
The courts have ruled that individuals have no right to police protection. The police have no legal obligation to protect you. I have the legal obligation to protect me. And what happens is when the council of the city of Washington, D.C. Says, you know what, you have to trust the cops. You're not smart enough. You're not safe enough. You have no legitimate need to defend your home. And people in Washington, D.C. who have defended their homes with firearms have gone to jail.
But by and large, the majority of the citizens in Washington, D.C. supported this law, and they kept these people in office. And so what you're arguing against is the democratic process.
Well, and you know this well, I've listened to you long enough to know that a democracy, let's use the old tried and true example. Democracy is two wolves inviting a sheep to dinner. All right,
what
are we going to eat? Now, when the majority of the people infringe upon the rights of the minority, okay, which is, by the way, what you happen in Jim Crow South. You have the majority of whites infringing the rights of blacks. Well, you're fighting against the democratically elected.
We're not talking, gun owners are not an ethnic minority.
No, they're not, but they still have a legitimate right to defend themselves. And that's what happens. The majority, 50% plus one of the city says nobody has a right to own the legitimate means of self-defense. And then what happens?
Well, that's legitimate is the key word there. I mean, do you want to make it a machine gun? Do you want
to force against lethal force?
So get a big
the
knife.
The name of it is the Swiss Report. I urge you to look it up. It's called the Swiss Report. Google it.
All right.
It's fascinating.
Thanks a lot, Frank. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 57 minutes. It's an interesting conversation. It's an interesting debate, and one that check out. See Bowling for Columbine. One that they don't have in other countries. It seems 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. The Senate just undid what Arlen Specter's, what a guy on Arlen Specter's staff had done, apparently without Arlen Specter knowing about it. Going to give me those two TPM Muckraker stories there, David? Thank you. This from TPM Muckraker Archives. Senator Arlen Specter confirmed that as Judiciary Committee Chairman last year, he made a last-minute change to a bill that expanded the administration's power to install U.S. attorneys without Senate approval. He says, I can confirm for you that, yes, it was a Specter provision. A spokesperson for the senator wrote in an email earlier today, this is from January 17th. Earlier we reported that Specter had been fingered for the last-minute change made in a select Republican-only meeting after the House and Senate had voted on earlier versions. Still, the mystery remains why Specter wanted the change, which arguably weakened the Senate's role. The senator made no public comment. Well, it increasingly looks like what happened was that Arlen Specter, back when he was going through chemo and everything else, and he was questioning the White House, and their power grabs, and questioning the legitimacy of the White House domestic spying operation, the White House listening into our telephone calls. And by the way, just along those lines, Gonzalez and the Justice Department now trying to tell the FBI, no paper trail, please. This is rather mind-boggling. This is in the Washington Post today. The FBI, which has been and reported over at Think Progress blog, thinkprogress.org, the Center for American Progress, the FBI, which has been criticized for improperly gathering telephone records in terrorism cases, has issued new rules for agents who want phone companies to voluntarily hand over their records. The new, and this is quoting from the Washington Post, the new instructions tell agents there is no need to follow up with national security letters or subpoenas. The agents are also told that the new letter template is the preferred method in emergencies, but they may make requests orally with no paperwork sent to phone companies. See, this administration is getting a little tired of there being evidence of their crimes against the Constitution and their crimes against we the people. So back to Arlen Specter. Specter's loyalty to the right-wingers in the administration is being questioned. And he's not doing so well, and so he puts this guy on his staff who, in tight with the White House, who slaps this thing into the Patriot Act, this sentence into the Patriot Act. The Senate just undid it. 94-2. Be interesting to know who those two votes were. We will track it down. A 94-2 vote, the Senate voted today to end the Bush administration's ability to unilaterally fill U.S. attorney vacancies as a backlash to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's firing of 8 federal prosecutors. It's from the Associated Press. Also over at Think Progress, the bill will cancel a Justice Department authorized provision in the Patriot Act that had allowed the Attorney General to appoint U.S. attorneys without Senate confirmation. This is all about the checks and balances that are built into the Constitution. And taking that to the next step, to point to just put a fine point on this, that this is not about Bush bad or Republicans bad or even conservatives bad or liberals good or Democrat, anything like that. I mean, first of all, to get 94 votes in the Senate, this has nothing to do with politics. And secondly, as Melinda Henenberger is reporting over at the Huffington Post, four prominent conservative thinkers are holding a press conference. Well, it happened about an hour and a half ago at the National Press Club. Former Georgia Congressman Bob Barr, who was on this program a couple of weeks ago. David Keene of the American Conservative Union. I'm not sure if we've had David on this program, but we certainly have had people from the ACU on. Richard Viguerie, who was on this program yesterday, as I recall. And constitutional scholar Bruce Fein, who served in the Reagan administration as Associate Deputy General, Deputy Attorney General. These four guys are calling for a package of legislation that they say will, and I'm quoting them, restore checks and balances and civil liberties protections under assault by the executive branch. They say since 9/11, the president has acquired too much power. They say that their goal for the legislative package, I'm quoting these four conservatives, is to restore congressional oversight and habeas corpus, end torture and extraordinary rendition, narrow the president's authority to designate enemy combatants, prevent unconstitutional wiretaps, email, and mail openings, and protect journalists from prosecution under the Espionage Act, and more. They call this the American Freedom Agenda. They're joint statement, the four signed a statement. They said, the President of the United States, George W. Bush, the President has encroached on the power of Congress to make laws and on the power of the courts to interpret the law, a scenario that the Founding Fathers foresaw and warned against. We, they say, are issuing this call to Americans of all political and philosophical persuasions to join us in urging Congress to enact the American Freedom Agenda. Now, what's interesting about this is because these four guys are conservatives, it's probably going to get a lot of press. But liberals, progressives, and Democrats have been saying this for 5 years. Where were you guys back in 2002, in 2003, in 2004, in 2005? You know, I salute what you're doing now, but it's a little after the fact, isn't it? I mean, when George Bush was out there saying, oh, yeah, I've got the right, I can do this, I can do anything I damn well please. We can, there's no problem at all. We can wiretap anybody. Where were the conservatives? Well, a lot of them were being good Republicans. They were, well, you know, let's see if we get some political benefit out of this. Brett Tolman. This is interesting. Spectre added, this is from Slate by Delilah Lithwick. Talking about Arlen Specter slipped the new provision into the Patriot Act in the dead of night. Arlen Specter himself says, the first I found out about the change in the Patriot Act occurred a few weeks ago when Senator Dianne Feinstein approached me on the floor. Specter added that he only looked into how the provision was altered after Feinstein told him about it, as he explained, quote, I then contacted my very able chief counsel, Michael O'Neill, to find out exactly what happened, and Mr. O'Neill advised me that the requested change had come from the Department of Justice, that it had been handled by Brett Tolman, who is now a U.S. attorney for Utah, and that the change had been requested by the Department of Justice because there had been difficulty with the replacement of a U.S. attorney in South Dakota. All right. And this guy, Brett Tolman, was working for Specter at that time. So Specter finds himself in an exceedingly strange position, as Delilah Lathwick points out. Either his staff lied to him and misled him, or he acknowledges to be a significant legal change. You know, he says, I didn't slip it in. I don't slip things in. This is not my practice. If there's some item which I have any idea is controversy, I tell everybody about it. Yeah. The conservatives, by the way, these four conservatives who are saying what the rest of us have been saying, what the rest of America has been saying, what presumably some of these federal prosecutors who were fired have been saying for the last 5 years. They say the AFA would roll back the alarming recent concentration of power in the White House and its end runs around due process. The AFA seeks to restore America's tradition of respect for the rule of law and the benefits of dispersed as opposed to concentrated power, to redeem the principle that no man is above the law, and to prevent injustices that undermine national security. And then they make the point, and this goes back even to our debate about gun control. They say, we are conservative scholars, activists, and writers. We do not favor a crippled executive or enfeebled government. In a time of danger, checks and balances make for stronger government, because the people will more readily accept a muscular authority if barriers against abuses are strong. At such future time, Congress, in turn, aggrandizes power and invades the executive or judicial domains. We will be equally alert to sound the alarm. But today, the clear and present danger to conservative philosophy is the White House. I would say today, the clear and present danger to American philosophy is the White House. This has nothing to do with conservative or liberal. And, you know, it's a fine thing that we've got four conservatives out there saying, yeah, well, we agree with American principles. But let's not call them conservative principles, okay? These are American principles. This is the foundational bedrock of America. And it's got nothing to do with conservative or liberal. Or arguably, it has everything to do with liberal, since the founders of this country were liberals coming out of the Enlightenment, saying that the people should have some defense against the government power. 16 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Have a nice day.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Christy Harvey is with us. She's the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress. She also creates the daily news prep site there, miccheckradio.org. Christy Harvey, welcome.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I am just great, but I'll get better. How about you, Christy?
Excellent. I'm right there with you. Right there with you.
Hey, alrighty. There's an awful lot in the news that's going on right now, and the Center for American Progress, probably every day I'm quoting your Think Progress blog on the air and attributing it, by the way. And I'm just curious, what in your mind are the real breaking stories right now, and what are the things that that you folks at the Center for American Progress are pushing the hardest? What do you think really should be the biggest stories right now?
Well, I think the entire city has almost shut down, waiting to see what's going to happen with all this Gonzalez stuff. It's become the biggest party game for people to guess what's going to happen next. There's betting pools, all sorts of things. And last night, the story everyone's talking about actually appeared on Politico, which is the new online mostly newspaper that a few journalists started from the Washington Post. And they have an inside source who's talking about the White House and how the White House is sniffing out possible replacements for Alberto Gonzalez when he gets that eventual boot.
Now, my recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I probably am, because this is just based on watching one of the network news shows last night, and I don't frankly remember which one, but I do remember that when this news came down, they said highly placed Republicans or some words to that effect are trying to suggest replacements to the White House, as opposed to the White House itself doing the search. Has the state of the art of knowledge of this been updated since then, or did I get it wrong?
What Politico is reporting is that the White House is talking to Republicans. So it did not say whether or not. It's probably that different Republicans are already starting to try and make their case to get their guy in.
Right. But so the White House is the recipient rather than the initiator here.
Right, although you have to keep in mind the fact that the White House isn't saying, no way, get out of here, we're not talking to you, we're not even going to address the fact, shows that they might know that the gig might be up. So we'll have to wait and see, but I think it's really interesting. The number one choice that we keep just hearing his name pop up so far is, and of course this is just a rumor, but is Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff.
Right.
So
well,
honestly,
safe.
I'm not sure if that's into the frying pan, into the fire, or what.
Well, he's been through Senate confirmation.
True.
He's considered to be a known quantity. He hasn't tarnished his reputation. He's in tight with Rudy Giuliani. Weren't they business partners at one point?
They were back in the day.
Yeah. So, he's a guy who's wired into the network. He's wired into the party. He's probably acceptable, at least to the moderate Democrats. And he's comported himself reasonably well as Director of Homeland Security. There haven't been any huge faux pas, at least that I know of.
No, he hasn't. And he has actually been very good at staying under the radar in a way that Tom Ridge was not when he was there before, and in the way that a lot of these big political types are too out there, I think, sometimes, and look too political. So
right.
Chertoff does have that going for him.
Now, there was a story. I'm sorry.
Sorry?
Go ahead. I was going to say there was a story that you folks floated yesterday over on your Think Progress blog of Carol Lamb targeting the White House, you know, asking this question, this $140,000 that goes from Dick Cheney's office to the contractor, Mitchell Wade, who pled guilty, and then from Mitchell Wade within a week from Mitchell Wade to buy a yacht, this exact same $140,000 in the form of a money order or something to buy a yacht for Randy Duke Cunningham. And that Carol Lamb might have been looking into the office of Dick Cheney. And I'm just curious. It seems like the mainstream media, the corporate media in America, completely ignored this. Is that because there's no story here, or has this gone any farther than the Think Progress blog?
It's gotten out there a little bit. I think the problem is that the mainstream media, I think, thinks this story is too wonky. It's not going to be the sexy, sexy thing that sells, you know, on headline news, because there are some, there's a little bit of meat to it. You have to actually take a little bit of time to understand the story. So I am hoping, last night the White House dumped 300 pages of emails, that are now out there, and people are starting to pick through and try and figure out who knew what, when, and how, and all of that good stuff. So I think as more people go through all of those emails and see what's going on, and these things keep popping up, like this Carol Lamb story, we'll start to get a bigger picture. Because
There's two problems with all these emails. One is that Karl Rove is using an RNC email address that probably isn't included in the document dumps, and two, Alberto Gonzalez doesn't use email.
Right. But they supposedly, the rumors are, I haven't gone through all of them yet, but the rumors are that it's very clear in a few of his deputies, Kyle Sampson's emails, that he has been in contact with his boss and with the White House. So he's shown as a definite link and says things like, when I was talking to Alberto, and that sort of thing, that hopefully we'll be able to tie him a little more closely.
Yeah, and it would be nice to tie this back to Mr. Bush, the ultimate employer here.
Let's see what we can do.
Time will tell. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress, the Director of Strategic Communications, AmericanProgress.org, ThinkProgress.org, MikeCheckRadio.org,
all three of them.
Right? Okay.
You can find us.
Christy, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Flame? Now, I don't think, because of their arrogance, I don't think the libs have any idea how this decision angers conservatives and Republicans in this country. They're poking the bear of conservatism and Republicans who went dormant last fall for whatever reason. The Republicans needed to be taught a lesson.
War in Iraq, but no WMDs. $500 billion down the toilet, please. That's no big deal, but convicting little Scooter ain't fair. You're poking the bear. W knows what's just and what's fairest. Put me in jail if you think I'm a terrorist. But nailing a guy for outing a spy curls my hair.
Oh, you can't have that.
You're poking the bear.
You're poking the bear.
You're poking the bear.
Poking the bear.
They can take
your
rights away, but lawyers
I
can pay to keep me out of jail and on the air.
You're poking the bear.
Poking the bear.
Don't be poking the bear.
Poking the bear.
Protecting Dick Cheney's a worthy mission. Fitzgerald's a fag who is only fishing. Lying's a crime for Bill Clinton, but not in this affair.
No, no. You're poking the bear.
Poking the bear. God, we can't have that, can we?
Poking the bear.
Poking the bear.
No, sir. People out there are upset. The libs are poking the bear. The bear is awakening after hibernating for way too long. This has the chance to do more for the Republican Party than anything else in the short run. And the more the Democrats gloat and the more they politicize this and the more they lie about what this case and this trial was about, the angrier they are going to make Republicans and conservatives in this country.
Yes, indeed. Oh, man. Thanks to Jim Turr from BlueCanyonSatire.com, BlueCanyonProductions.com for poking the bear there. Yes, Mr. Limbaugh advising us that we had better be careful with this Scooter Libby verdict because it's going to upset all the Republicans, and you just can't be poking that bear because that bear is going to wake up. Yes. Tell me, speaking of poking, tell me how this helps us be safe. David Hicks, this is from today's New York Times. You know, back to abusive process, back to these four conservatives who have come out and said the violation, the use of torture, the elimination of habeas corpus, the elimination of basic human rights is anti-conservative. And as I'm saying, it's anti-American. Please tell me how this helps the United States be free and safe and gain respect in the world. Because frankly, ultimately, the only thing that keeps us safe is the moral authority that we're viewed with by other countries. No battalion of nuclear missiles is going to protect you, as we found out on 9/11. No airport security is going to. Ultimately, it comes down to, do we have the moral force that everybody in the world will join us in hunting down people who harm us? So there's this incredible juxtaposition in today's news. An article on the front page of USA Today. Could peace finally be at hand in Northern Ireland? About what happens when you deal with terrorists who believe that they have a legitimate cause and mission, when you deal with them and their terror techniques as criminals. And you do so from a highly moral position. Keep in mind, Maggie Thatcher got blown up nearly. I mean, these guys blew up number 10 Downing Street. Or right next door to it. And killed a number of people in the United Kingdom. And the United Kingdom was able to mobilize the indignation of the world against terrorism in Northern Ireland. And there were Americans, there were Americans in Irish bars in Boston raising money for the IRA. And no, they weren't declared enemy combatants and shipped off to the British equivalent of Guantanamo Bay. What we did was we used world public opinion to say what these guys are doing is wrong. And they changed their behavior. And many of them went to jail. I mean, this is very straightforward stuff. So how does it, to back to my original point, tell me how this helps the United States gain the kind of moral authority that we would need to be able to say to the people of the world, Osama bin Laden has harmed us, help us arrest this guy and put him in jail. Or anybody else, I mean, fill in the blank. David, this is from the New York Times, Raymond Bonner writing in today's New York Times. David Hicks, Dateline London. David Hicks, the first detainee to be formally charged under the new military tribunal rules at Guantanamo Bay. The first. Now, here we are, 5 years later, or 4 years later. The first guy to actually be charged has alleged in a court document filed here that during more than 5 years in American custody, he was beaten during interrogations and witnessed the abuse of other prisoners. In an affidavit supporting his request for British citizenship, Mr. Hicks, he's an Australian citizen, by the way, contends that before he arrived at Guantanamo, his American captors threw him and other detainees on the ground, walked on them, stripped him naked, shaved all his body hair, and inserted a plastic object into his rectum. The abuse, Mr. Hicks asserts, began during interrogations in Afghanistan, where he was captured in late 2001. It then continued while he was shuttled between American naval ships, aircraft, unknown buildings, and Kandahar before he was taken to the military detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in early 2002, according to the affidavit. Keep in mind, this is about the time that Mr. Gonzalez was writing the memo to Mr. Bush saying that the Geneva Conventions are quaint. Mr. Hicks claims that he was given regular mysterious injections that would, quote, make my head feel strange, end quote. A detainee, I'm still reading from the New York Times story here, a detainee with only one leg was set upon by a special military team and its dogs, he said. The man was dragged out of his cell and there was blood on his face in the cell floor. Said Hicks, it put me in such fear that I just knew I would cooperate in any way with the U.S. Mr. Hicks is Australian, but his mother was born in Britain. He will plead not guilty to a single charge of providing material support for terrorism. The initial charges against him, including attempted murder and aiding the enemy, have been dropped. Mr. Hicks said he could hear other detainees screaming in pain when being interrogated. He said he was later transferred to the amphibious assault ship Bataan, where he said conditions became drastically worse. He was fed only a handful of rice or fruit three times a day, the affidavit asserts, and on several occasions he and other detainees, blindfolded, hooded, and handcuffed, were thrown into helicopters and taken to hangar-like buildings in an unknown location. They were forced to kneel for 10 hours, during which time, quote, I was hit on the back of the head with the butt of a rifle several times hard enough to knock me over, slapped in the back of the head, kicked, stepped on, and spat on. I could hear the groans and cries of other detainees. A week or so later, he was flown to Kandahar, where he and other detainees, quote, were forced to lie down in mud while soldiers walked across our backs. He was stripped, his body hair shaved, and a piece of white plastic was forcibly inserted, quoting him, in my rectum for no apparent purpose, end quote, he wrote. Soldiers made crude comments about the insertion, he said. At Guantanamo, he was shown a picture of Mahmoud Habib, another Australian, who was picked up in Pakistan, turned over to the United States and delivered to Egypt, where he was badly tortured. At Guantanamo, Mr. Hicks says he was shown the picture of Mr. Habib. In the photo, Habib's face was black and blue, he wrote. At first, I thought it was the photo of a corpse, he said, adding that an interrogator told him that if he did not cooperate, he too would be sent to Egypt to suffer the same fate. He said, this regular brutality left me in a heightened state of fear and anxiety about my own safety. This is how we're demonstrating to the world what good guys we are. Sandra in Concord, California. Hey, Sandra, welcome to the program.
Good morning, good afternoon. I don't know where you are.
I'm in Portland, Oregon. It's a good morning here, but
I'd like to be there with you. Hey, I just want to say just a couple things real quick, and one of them is, you know, I don't know why everybody's being so mean to Al. I think he's doing a heck of a job. You know?
Well, that's essentially what Bush said today. You know, he called Alberto Gonzalez and said, you know, Al, you're doing a heck of a job, and I fully support you, which I assume is the predicate, is the kiss of death.
Well, I mean, I met Arianna Huffington 3 years ago, and I said to her, why do people not say this guy is incompetent? It was obvious to me that he was incompetent even before he was president, ever. So I don't understand, after a term in office, why people couldn't understand that he was incompetent.
Go ahead. You finish.
I was just saying that she said that they were choosing, Kerry's camp was choosing not to go that way. But, yeah. I mean, maybe there should be a test or something for the president, you know, like a comprehension test.
So you're suggesting that it was Bush who was incompetent. His history certainly demonstrates that. I was surprised that Gonzalez was confirmed. I mean, his confirmation hearing, he was talking down to the senators. He was doing an almost, Truman Capote looking down his nose, well, Senator.
I agree. But, you know, it's like I said, he obviously hires all these people that are his friends, and Cheney and all these people do, because they have this loyalty thing. I mean, people forget about the loyalty oaths they used to have people sign.
I agree with you, Sandra. And I think it goes beyond just loyalty. If you look at narcissistic personality disorder, you've heard of people who are the kiss-up, kick-down types. This was John Bolton was referred to as this by one of his former employees. People, narcissistic personality disorder types, it's a form of sociopathy. These types can only bond with either people that they have total power over and who completely love them no matter what, or with people who have absolute power over them. They can't even identify with other people as being human who aren't in one of those two categories. They can either kiss up or kick down. They can do nothing else. And I am very concerned that that describes George Bush. And Gonzalez is kickdown guy. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is going to be with us in just a second. First, Jeff in Tacoma, you had a quick question. I wanted to answer it.
Actually, yeah, I thought about it, and I realized you haven't given a thing for folks to do today. They should call their friends and tell them it's not enough just to repeal this screwed-up law that guy slipped in there, but that guy got a job from it. And so maybe we need to get rid of these new fools and put the old attorneys back in.
Well, here's the problem with that, Jeff, and that is, and a good point. I guess, you know, ultimately the question, why isn't the Senate reinstating the old attorneys? And I don't disagree with you that it would be a cool thing if they did, but that would be a violation of the power of the separation of powers. The president, the executive branch, because the attorneys do work for the executive branch actually does and should have the power and authority to appoint them, even the political appointees. And the Senate must have the power to say yes or no to those persons, what's the word, Ellen? It's not ratify.
Advise and consent.
Yeah, okay. All right, there you go. To say yes, you are now the U.S. attorney. And, the Senate has to have that power. And so that's why, you know, the Senate can't put them back in. It would have to go through the executive branch. And apparently it's not. And they are gumming to death the guy down in Arkansas who's Karl Rove's protege. Their strategy was to gum this thing to death, to stretch it out so that he can stay in office until Bush is no longer president, which is 671 days, 10 hours, 4 minutes, and 14 seconds. And it looks like they're going to be successful. Ellen, hey, welcome.
Thank you so much. Yes, the Senate does have an advise and consent in this. And today on the president's way to Kansas, where he is pushing good energy cars, because, of course, tomorrow is when Gore speaks to both the Senate and the House. We are going to find that the president, of course, is going to look Mr. Green and Mr. Energy. But today, the gaggle was done by Tony Snow on the plane. And essentially, Tony Snow said, well, you know, we've been very forthcoming. We released 3,000 pages of documents. You can go through them yourself. The president called Gonzalez this morning. He has full confidence in them, in Mr. Gonzalez. Well, did they discuss how long Gonzalez was going to stay? No, the president and Mr. Gonzalez did not stay there, but he wanted him to know before he left this morning that he has full confidence in him.
Ellen,
any of this was political or not, Tony then said, you know, well, it depends what you mean by political. You know, everything we basically do is political, but, I mean, he didn't quite say it in that way, but that's clearly what he meant. And he then said, the president felt that these firings were justified. I mean, they are not moving on their line one
iota. You got to
give
them to them. They don't.
They
move.
Can't. I mean, the minute they do, they'll be eaten alive. But the question in my mind is these 3,000 documents that were just released and the two sets that had preceded them. When you consider the fact that Karl Rove has not been using, well, perhaps occasionally he's been using the official White House government, we paid for it, therefore we can subpoena it email address. But he's also been using GWB43.org, I guess it is. Karl Rove at or KR at or whatever, and KR at GOP.org. He's been using Republican Party email addresses while he's working inside the White House. Now, I don't think that's illegal, you know, if he's doing Republican Party work.
I think the Clintonians did it too, but
right.
You're right.
Yeah, I don't think it's illegal, but it may put those. So here we have Rove, who has a second or third or fourth email address that has nothing to do with the government and therefore arguably may be outside the purview of a document dump or a subpoena. And you have Gonzalez, who doesn't even have an email account. And it seems, and please tell me if I'm right on this or not, it seems that the only documents that are being released are emails.
Right now, the 3,000 documents that were released were emails. That's correct.
So they're releasing emails, and everybody is trying to implicate the two guys who are, one of them doesn't use email, and the other guy uses email addresses that are may not be subject to this document dump. And so they're saying, fine, we'll give you everything you want except what you want.
Well, or except any smoking guns. Exactly. Very typical of how this White House operates.
So why is the news media not pointing that fact out, that they're being played, that we're all being played by as suckers by the White House?
Well, I think because, first of all, the people that currently, this was not a full press conference. It was a gaggle on the plane. So it's generally, you know, one representative from the larger TV networks, and they're not generally the sort of journalists that do anything except for, you know, a few-minute report. And so I think that when this gets to the full press, or when this gets before Congress, you'll get more information.
Yeah, this seems to me like, you know, a really big question. If Alberto Gonzalez does not use email at all, period. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, when you're prosecuting the mafia, you know, this is an old thing in the mafia. You never write anything down. You never talk about it over the telephone where it might be wiretapped. You tell a courier, in, you know, as you're walking in a park or something, and then the courier goes and tells somebody else, and if the courier suddenly becomes a government witness, you kill the courier. I mean, this is the, you know, the old mob technique, and it looks like Gonzalez and Rove have been using this technique.
Well,
I don't know about
the kill
the courier part, but
I mean, what I even say to all our staff and our interns is don't ever write anything in an email that you don't want on the front page of the Washington Post.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's
and
that's
clearly they don't either.
Yeah, good point. But, you know, when they're doing our business, their correspondence, frankly, should be subject to oversight by us, I think.
Absolutely.
But, yeah. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen, for sharing. Good talking with you, sharing your insights with us today. Tomorrow will be an interesting day. I'll be challenging Robert Peters on the difference between indecency, pornography, and free speech. And Jeremy Scahill is going to be here to tell you everything you never wanted to know, you really actually want to know, about Blackwater. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.